Our text on the second Sunday of Lent is from the 8th chapter of the Gospel of Mark. And this is what's known as Jesus' first passion prediction. For the first time, he tells the disciples and us just where he's headed. And I'm actually going to back up from the order of worship and pick up our text in the 27th verse of that 8th chapter. Jesus went on with his disciples to the villages of Caesarea Philippi, and on the way he asked his disciples, "Who do people say that I am?" And they answered him, "John the Baptist, and others Elijah, and still others one of the prophets." He asked them, "But who do you say that I am?" Peter answered him, "You're the Messiah." And he sternly ordered them not to tell anyone about him. Then he began to teach them that the Son of Man must undergo great suffering and be rejected by the elders, the chief priests, and the scribes, and be killed, and after 3 days rise again. He said all this quite openly. And Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. But turning and looking at his disciples, he rebuked Peter and said, "Get behind me, Satan, for you're setting your mind not on divine things, but on human things." He called the crowd with his disciples and said to them, If any want to become my followers, let them deny themselves, take up their cross, and follow me. For those who want to save their life will lose it. And those who lose their life for my sake and for the sake of the gospel will save it. For what will it profit them to gain the whole world and forfeit their life? And may God bless this reading and hearing of this holy word. In her memorable book, Death Comes for the Archbishop, Willa Cather tells of the Acoma Indians who, after too many encounters with danger, finally chose to leave the plains and move up to the high mesas. They believed that up on those rocks, they would at last find safety. "These Indians," she wrote, "born in fear and dying by violence, had at last taken the leap away from the earth and had found the hope of all suffering and tormented creatures, safety." But, she added, "in their flight to this safety, these Indians lost their vitality, their spark, their involvement in life, and eventually died out. Safe was not saved." But oh, how we like to be safe. "If any want to become my followers, let them deny themselves, take up their cross, and follow me. For those who want to save their life will lose it, and those who lose their life for my sake will save it." Now, what do such words say about our human desire for safety and security? About our preference for a sure thing? Losing life to save it? Taking up a cross? You know, those aren't phrases one generally puts in a church brochure or a newspaper ad. "Come to worship and lose your life with us. See you Sunday. Call 823-2484 for more information." Not going to happen. As I was reflecting on these challenging, even troubling words of Jesus, I came across these words from Tom Robbins in his book, Another Roadside Attraction. He says, "You've risked your life, but what else have you ever risked? Have you ever risked disapproval? Have you ever risked economic security? Have you ever risked a belief? I see nothing particularly courageous in risking one's life. So you lose it. You go to your hero's heaven and everything is milk and honey till the end of time, right? You get your reward and suffer no earthly consequences. That's not courage. Real courage is risking something you have to keep on living with. Real courage is risking something that might force you to rethink your thoughts and suffer change and stretch consciousness. Real courage is risking one's cliches. Well, could that be the challenge, even the threat of this encounter with Jesus? You know, he doesn't seem very interested in safety. Rather, he seems to want to know, what are we willing to risk as we walk the Jerusalem road with him? Now, in today's text, as I said, for the very first time in the gospel, Jesus tells his disciples and us just where he's going. They're on the other side of the Jordan River, Caesarea Philippi, far from home and familiar territory. And so he uses this time and place to quiz them a little bit. Who do people say that I am? And they give him fairly standard, fairly safe answers. Some say you're John the Baptist, some Elijah, one of the prophets. Basically, they're saying to Jesus that he's an enlargement of something they already know. But Peter, the lead disciple, he dares to take things a bit further. You're not just another prophet or teacher. You are the Christ. You're the Messiah, the long-awaited one who will free and redeem Israel. Way to go, Peter. Finally. We're 8 chapters into the gospel, and finally, someone besides a demon dares to speak the truth about Jesus. I'm glad Peter's cleared it up for us once and for all. Or has he? Because it quickly and painfully becomes clear that Peter's concept of Messiah and Jesus' concept of Messiah aren't even in the same ballpark. Then he began to teach them, the Son of Man must suffer many things, be rejected, and even killed. What was that? Did he just say what I thought he said? You can imagine Peter taking out the Messiah-disciple contract and going over it again, you know, reading the fine print. This isn't right. This isn't what Messiahs do. A proper Messiah brings liberating power. A proper Messiah ends Roman repression and returns Israel to its former glory. A proper Messiah sets the world right once and for all. Messiahs do not suffer and die. So he takes Jesus aside and rebukes him. This is strong language. This is not just a polite discussion among colleagues. There's anger here. I love the honesty of Mark because Jesus comes right back at him. He, in turn, rebukes Peter. Rebuke. A word Mark uses for how Jesus deals with demons. He rebukes them. This is what he's doing with Peter. And then just for good measure, he adds, "Get behind me, Satan!" Ouch. Right here, we are at the heart of Jesus' mission. We are at the heart of what it means to follow this particular Messiah. So he uses strong language, does not want there to be any doubt. And then, as if he hasn't already said enough, he adds, "And if you want to become my followers, deny yourselves, take up a cross, and follow me." Is this the Jesus we signed up to follow? You know, I don't remember Gene mentioning this text in that new members class. There's such a radical discontinuity between God's purposes and our purposes, between Jesus' way and our way of safety and security. Minister shares this story. I was visiting a storefront church in one of our major cities. For the Sunday service, 15 or 16 people, mostly homeless men and women, gathered to sing hymns, pray, and hear a sermon. After the service, as I talked with the pastor, I asked, "You ever get discouraged that you don't have more people come to your church?" "Discouraged?" he asked in surprise. "Why should I be discouraged? I remember Jesus only got about 12. We always get more than that. And when you consider the craziness of this city, the mad pursuit of stuff, the materialism, the lies, I always think it's rather amazing that Jesus is able to find all around 20 people who are crazy enough to follow him. Concludes his pastor. You know, when one considers the narrow way of the cross that Jesus calls us to, it's amazing that even a dozen showed up to walk with him. But you showed up. I showed up. Choir showed up. What do we do with this Messiah who contradicts everything a proper Messiah should be? I believe that when Jesus begins to teach that he wants to give the disciples and us a new understanding of who he is. He is not simply the same old thing. He's something unexpected, something new. And I think he wants those who follow him to experience that unexpected newness in their lives. You might say what we have here is an invitation. An invitation to reimagine our lives, to see ourselves living out a different story than the one we thought we were living. To see ourselves as participating in a new reality. To see ourselves as created, not simply for success and wealth and prosperity and happiness, but rather created for a relationship with and service to a living and surprising and unexpected God. So he wants to know, are we willing to take the risk of such a relationship, of reimagining our lives? Or are we going to play it safe? Pastor writes, a man came to me saying how deeply concerned he was about some of the practices at his workplace. He detected a clear pattern of how some people were promoted and some not promoted solely because of the color of their skin. His boss repeatedly passed over workers who performed well and were a credit to their company because of their race. As his pastor, I urged him to be careful. Careful how he broached the subject with his boss. He ought to find out if there were others in the company who shared his concern. He needed to be very careful before entering any discussion about possible racial discrimination. He should not come across as holier than thou or self-righteous. He followed my advice and eventually confronted his boss. A month later, he was unceremoniously fired. It took him nearly a year to find another job, largely due because of his boss's poor opinion of him. When he finally found a job, it was not nearly as good as the one he had lost. Now, I'm sorry. I suppose I could have found a story where the good guy wins in the end. But I guess you could say, in a way, this man did win. He chose the path of honesty and integrity. He emerged with his soul intact. He was not like that famous man in the gray flannel suit. Someone who will say and do anything for pay. And I think this is where Jesus is taking us in this text, especially when he speaks of the cross. He's pointing toward his life as a path for our journey. This is not a call to success or a promise that everything's going to turn out all right in the end. It is a call to discipleship. a call to forget playing it safe and be willing to confront whatever powers are out there standing in the way of the saving and liberating power of God. What's our focus going to be? Are we ready to share Christ's story, to participate in the new reality of God's reign, even when it is anything but safe? Do we really want to reach out to others caringly and trustingly if later on it's going to cost us tears? Do we really want to expose ourselves to the possibility of hurt or disappointment or rejection? Do we really want to get this close to Jesus if later he's going to ask us to do something really heroic or worthwhile or risky with our lives? Oh, I don't know, even losing them to save them. Boy, what a nice sanctuary in here. It's so nice and peaceful in here. But the point of our faith is not simply to sit in safety and listen to Jesus' teaching. It's to get out there and take the risk of living that teaching. One final story told by a colleague. I was admiring the beautiful sanctuary. Church had gone through an expensive renovation, installed an impressive new pipe organ right at the front of the sanctuary. I admired the beauty of the room. Something seemed to be missing. You probably noticed we don't have a cross in front, said the host pastor. I had to confess, I hadn't really noticed. Frankly, he said, once we got the new organ installed, dominating the front of the church like it does, just wasn't room for a cross. Concludes my colleague. Take this as sort of a parable of many of our churches today. Amid all of our busyness and programs and service and beauty, just no room for the cross. Let us pray. It's actually a prayer from Reinhold Niebuhr. O Lord, who has taught us that to gain the whole world and to lose our souls is great folly, grant us the grace so to lose ourselves that we may truly find ourselves anew in the life of grace, and so to forget ourselves that we may be remembered in your kingdom. Amen.